No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People the Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I'm joined by my co-host Maria Sanchez, and together we hope our show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So feel free to call in with any questions at 888-627-6008. Welcome, Maria. I'm sorry I'm getting tongue-tied here for some reason. I don't know why. Maybe it's my old age.
We were just speaking about that. So I don't know about you, Michael, but life in California is almost back to normal, and on June 15th will be. But last night, my fiance and I had my son and his wife over for dinner because they had reached their two vaccines plus 14 days on Thursday. And it says that two vaccines plus 14 days people can be with one another without social distancing and without face masks and indoors. And then my other son and his wife stopped by this afternoon just to say hello. So it's like, and we're all getting together a week from today. It's just like, it feels like it was forever, and then it feels like it was just a dream.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know that things have quite gotten back to normal here yet. But you're starting to see it. The weather in Washington has been nice lately. So you're seeing more and more people out, some without masks. Lots of people have been vaccinated in the District of Columbia. I think we're doing really, really well in that. And, so we're getting there slowly but surely. And I've been vaccinated. I'm not sure. I haven't talked to my son, Nick, in a couple of days. He was on a list. I'm not sure if he's gotten it, but my two daughters have gotten vaccinated. Pat was one of the first people because she was a teacher to get vaccinated. And so, yeah, we're hoping it gets back to normal, but there's got to be a new normal, right?
I mean, well, yes, because I can't see us. Here in California, we're still being asked to wear a mask in public.
Yeah, we are too.
People are adhering to that. In fact, about a month ago, somebody in the grocery store wasn't wearing a mask, and I said something to the manager who happened to be checking me out. He said, we already talked to him. He said he has a medical condition that precludes him or prevents him from wearing a mask. So whether or not that's true, I guess we can't check it out. But in general, it is the exception. And as you know, Californians aren't normally known for following the rules. We tend to think outside the box. But when it comes to this, it's been fairly remarkable that, I guess it's because, I don't know, I'm sure you on the East Coast too, but we feel like we paid such a high price, we don't want to jeopardize that. So if that's what we have to do, that's what we have to do.
Yeah, and you know, I saw Dr. Fauci on this morning on Meet the Press, and he said the reason that vaccinated people still have to wear masks is that they can contract a virus and not even know it and pass it on to people that aren't vaccinated.
Which is why they said, because I just looked up the CDC guidelines to make sure that I was current as of this moment in time, and it went through the five reasons why, and one of them was that if you are visiting with people who have been double vaccinated plus the 14 days, there are no restraints anymore. You can hug and you can hang out and everything else. What they also said is that if you live away from your family and you've been double vaccinated, you can visit with family that hasn't been vaccinated as long as they live in one household.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we're going to start to get used to those sort of things, but I don't know what kind of impact it's going to have. Before we go any further, let me just say that we put out on the internet that we were going to have civil rights icon Dori Ladner as our guest tonight. Unfortunately, we have not been able to get in touch with Ms. Ladner, who is will be 80 next month, and she had a slip and fall accident. So we hope that she's okay. This was a while ago, but she's still recuperating. So I don't know if that's the problem, whatever the problem is. But we apologize if you're tuning in to hear Dori, and we hope to, you know, get her on a future broadcast so that we can talk about her amazing career. But
what a legacy. Okay. I mean, a living legend, if you will.
Really.
And that slip and fall thing, my dad did that, and he never walked again. He was bedbound. He had a spiral femur fracture over it, and that was it for him. It's like, it's so terrible, and it's something as innocent as, I just fell in the past 3 weeks. I did a face plant because I tripped on something the backyard, and I was like, that's how this happens.
Well, and you know what? We did a shout out last week to Janet Brown.
Yes.
And that's how she passed away. She slipped and fell, and Janet had been a guest on her show. She went to the Civil Rights March on Washington, and she went to the 50th anniversary march. So we had her and her husband on. They're unfortunately both gone now, but that's what happened to her, slip and fall. And you know, I'm in physical therapy because I fell a couple times, and they've got, you know, everybody's got me worried about it. So, be careful out there. And we hope Miss Ladner's okay, and we send our best to her. But
thank you for that.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you would, because I found it fascinating since we spoke on the phone in real time on Friday, if you could talk about that was the reason for booking the guest too, what that meant to the District of Columbia on April 16th.
Emancipation Day?
Yep.
Well, Emancipation Day, you know, it's our only holiday here in the District of Columbia, our only official holiday. And it was revived. It's really an interesting story, I think. It was revived by this lovely lady who, Loretta Carter Haynes, who did a bunch of research on it, revived it in the 1980s, and made it a national. It's only been a holiday in the District of Columbia for a very short time. We passed legislation since I've been elected. So in the past dozen years or so, but it commemorates April 16th, 1862, when Abraham Lincoln, a Republican, by the way, bought 3,100 slaves and freed them in the only compensated emancipation in our history. And I think it was probably the only compensated emancipation anywhere. But they bought all 3,100 slaves. They set them free. This was 9 months before the Emancipation Proclamation. I guess you'd have to call it a public relations move, you know, that they wanted to, he had control over the nation's capital, and he wanted to implement this policy, and so he did this first as kind of a precursor. And at the beginning, African Americans, especially in Washington, D.C., would come out and celebrate it every year with a big parade. And it was such a big event that the president himself would come to the parade, whoever the president was, every year for several years. But then in the late 1800s, early 1900s, the parade stopped, the celebration stopped, and it kind of died. And then all of a sudden, this woman, Loretta Carter Haynes, back in the 1980s, started working on it, and it took her about 20 years to revive it. She got a councilman to a guy named Vincent Orange, who was on the city council, to propose legislation. It passed, and now we have a national holiday. Everything in D.C. is closed on April 16th, and we celebrate it every year. And you know, the amazing thing is she has records, which are so interesting, of every sale, because it was a government thing, right? So they kept a record of it. The government kept a record of it. And if you were, you know, if you were a woman in, let's say, your 40s, which they would have considered beyond childbearing age in those days, you would get compensated $100. Your owner would get compensated $100. But if you were a man and you were 18 years old, they would get several thousand dollars, maybe $5,000 compensation for you, because you were seen as you know, much more valuable. In fact, women didn't get very much at all, even the young women. You know, it's interesting. They kept all 3,100. They've got a record of each sale and how much it sold for, and you know, and who the people came from. And so, yeah, it's an interesting piece in history. And we're so glad that she revived it and found it, and has now, you know, added to the culture of the District of Columbia.
Well, and what I found interesting, because I did a little digging after we spoke, is that that act happened 8 months before the Emancipation Proclamation, and that the District of Columbia is the only entity in the United States to have compensated slave owners for freeing enslaved persons.
Yeah. And you know what?
That's a lot.
Yeah, and we also, believe me, we use it. I just did a couple of videos for it the other day. We use it to remind people that of the irony that slaves were first freed in the District of Columbia, but still the people of the District of Columbia are not full-fledged citizens. So, you know, we try to highlight that every April 16th. It's like it all comes at once. You know, April 15th, we all stand up and we used to burn our tax returns, and April 16th, we have Emancipation Day. We remind people, yeah, that we still haven't been fully emancipated.
And to that end, can you talk about the campaign that you're going to begin with, the poster that you've made?
Yeah, can I tell you something? I just got a text message that Dory is waiting for us to call her. And you know what? They've given me another phone number. So maybe we can get her on.
Can you put that in the chat?
Wait a second. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. Yeah. I'm having a hard time using the chat here. Oh, here we go.
Yes. You know what? Publicize that.
Yeah, you shouldn't deal with old people, Marina. Technologically, let's see. Okay, it was one number off.
Nice.
Okay, and so I'm sending this on its way. And and we'll see if we can get Dory. That'd be great.
Yes.
Yeah.
Dory Ladner.
Yeah, Dory Ladner. And this is internet radio for you guys. You know, it's live. It's sometimes stuff happens. So
well, that happens on terrestrial radio too.
It does.
Yes, it does.
It's good to know.
I can't tell you how many times that wires would get crossed about things. And it's like, wait a second, we already had this prearranged. It's like, yeah, well, you know, there's people. get in the way.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, while we're waiting.
Why didn't you tell people about her? What I found interesting, it says wrong number, was that she was inspired by Medgar Evers. And he's a icon, as far as I'm concerned, also in my life.
I'm sorry, who, Medgar Evers? Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
And that
I'm
was
sorry, did we get Laura? Did we get, wait.
No, they said wrong number.
Okay. Then I would try the original number again, Don, and see if we can't get her. Okay, because she may be waiting at the original number.
That could be.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that how you know of her? Because I didn't know.
I know of her. She came to our event last year.
Oh, that's right. The Dick Gregory event.
Dick Gregory, right. And you know, we invited her because of who she is and weren't sure whether she would come or not. And she did. She showed up. And so that's when I first met her. And, you know, when we talked last week on the phone, and we have much in common in that we were volunteers for Obama and we worked we worked for Jimmy Carter together, you know, we never knew each other, but we did a lot of the same things.
Well, the thing I found interesting is that she was a member of the NAACP as an adolescent. So, I mean, she got active right away. And apparently there's no answer.
Now, you know what, Doug? Can we have somebody sending us this information? So can you just put the call up? Can we just put, what's the call-in number? Let's see if we can get her to call in.
Well, that's a good idea for her to call BBS
yeah,
Radio.
Yeah, I mean, can she use the regular number? Yes.
888.
Yeah, 888. Anise Jenkins, if you're out there listening, the number is 888-627-6008 because we can't reach Dory on our own somehow. But anyway, let's carry on and hopefully we'll get her you know, and by the way, we tried both numbers and we can't seem to reach her. So if she could get her to call in, that'd be great. But, you know, something that we've really got to say something about, and this got me in a lot of trouble, Maria. I responded to someone who put, I know you're a former member of the NRA. I don't know if you're still a member.
No, I'm not. My dad was.
But somebody put up a picture of an AR-15 rifle and said, let's see if we can get 10,000 likes for this. And this was on LinkedIn. And I just couldn't resist. I had to say, look, you know, there's been 20 mass murders in the last 12 days. I'm sorry, 12 mass murders in the last 20 days. And to put this rifle up there and ask people to like it, I thought was horrible. Well, I got to tell you, the people came out of the woodwork, and I got assaulted on all sorts of levels, you know, that had nothing to do with
it. So they made it personal towards you.
Yes, and it didn't have anything to do with the comment I made. You know, the comment I made, it didn't have anything to do with you know, they started talking about the importance of the Second Amendment and what it meant, and all I said is, you don't put a picture of this assault weapon out there and ask people to like it in the midst of all this. Didn't say I was against the Second Amendment. Didn't say I was against gun ownership. Didn't even say I was against AR-15 rifles, which, by the way, I am. But never even said that. And just went nuts. And I don't know what's going on in America right now. I have a feeling that some of it's got to be connected to the pandemic, but I just don't get it. And
so you know what I've noticed? I did notice, so social media, we call them trolls because there's that anonymity. People say and do things that they wouldn't do in person on the, you know, through the internet, which is part of my degree in media psychology is the psychology behind the use of media. But the other thing is that I know that COVID made people grouchy and grumpy and anxious and depressed. Oh, yeah. And I have a next door neighbor, and we usually walk like 2 or 3 days a week. And she used to, early on, she started like yelling at me on our walks. And I thought, I haven't done anything to deserve your wrath. And I realized she's grouchy. And so I decided I don't need this. So our friendship hasn't really endured because of it. Because she was triangulating with me. Her husband is infirm. He's a cancer survivor. So he couldn't go out at all because of his lungs, period. And so she was stuck, and I get it. But I don't want to be the object of that. Like, it's not my problem. I didn't do it. You know? So I do think it's a combination of the COVID reaction and the social media anonymity. But it's terrible. I mean, I see it. Do you, if you belong to Nextdoor, the little bulletin board, people get at it on that. And as soon as I get that there's rancor going on, I'm like, out of there. I don't want to read that. They'll say, how petty of you to say that, or that was small, or that was this. They don't even know each other, and they're speaking to one another that way.
Yeah. It's horrible sometimes that, you know, and that's what stopped me. It's funny that you said that, but somebody finally typed in, and they said, you're a United States senator, and you're trolling these people, you know?
And we have Dory.
We have Dory! Yay! Dory Ladner, we're so glad that you joined the show. How are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you, and all of you.
Fine. And we're sorry there was a little mix-up in the beginning, but now we have with us. Now we have with us, and just so our audience knows, Dory Ladner, who's a civil rights icon. She was a member and an organizer of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. She was participated in every civil rights march from 1963 to 1968, including the March on Washington, the marches from Selma to Montgomery, and the Poor People's March. And spent 30 years, and this is really a lot of what I want to discuss tonight. She spent 30 years as a clinical social worker. So thank you so much for being on the show, Ms. Ladner. We so much appreciate it. And let me start by saying, by asking you the question, what's different today that we see in this kind of new effort for civil rights, things like Black Lives Matter? What's different about this movement today than it was in the 1960s?
Well, I would say that you have more communication, meaning cell phones, all kinds of device that you can mobilize people with quicker than we could, you know, because we were using telegrams and cars and anything, word of mouth, to pass our messages on for organizing purposes.
But did you get better organization that way? I mean, right? When you're touching people, do you think that works better than all of us getting on social media? Or do you think that social media is really a benefit for all of us?
No, I wouldn't say that it's better or worse. It furthers the mobilization. Whereas we had to maybe drive from Selma to Montgomery or to Mississippi and in those cars and facing danger, you know, with the hands of the police and highway patrol and so forth. But we were young and made time. But I can't say one was necessarily better. It may have been faster. We, SNCC, had the, what we call the time, watch line. Mm-hmm. Meaning that it was like 411, 911 to alert us to, maybe to say that our comrade was in peril. For instance, when Swerna Cheney and Goodman didn't show up at 3:30 that afternoon, that evening, we knew that something was wrong. So we had to start tracing, like you're doing the tracing here with these viruses. We had to go back and trace and trace and trace and trace. And we knew that they were in the jail, but they were not released in, gotten out in a timely fashion. Federal authorities were notified. Everyone knew that, that they were there.
And, yeah, that was a horrible situation. And many of you may know about this from, they did a movie several years ago called Mississippi Burning about these civil rights workers that, that were murdered in Mississippi. And I can't remember whether they, who was convicted. I know that ultimately there was a trial and there were several people.
Rain and Price, the sheriff and a deputy and some others. It was an agreement made with the feds and others.
Well, I read that you first got involved. I'm sorry, Marie, I'm kind of monopolizing things here, but
I'm patiently waiting.
I know you are. I read that you first got involved as a teenager because of the story, you know, hearing about Emmett Till, which
we all know was
a young man that was murdered. And recently CNN has done a special on a woman from South Carolina.
Caroline Bryant, she was the wife of one of the men who killed him.
Yeah. And you also knew Medgar Evers. Is that right? Very well, yes. And another civil rights icon that was murdered by a guy named Beckwith, I think. Took years and years.
Mr. Evers was the field secretary for the NAACP in the state of Mississippi.
And it took years and years to convict him.
And
what a horrible situation that was. But he was finally convicted. I remember it wasn't very long ago that he was convicted, actually.
No, it was a dogged work of several people who finally brought him to justice. And he was an unrepentant segregationist.
Yeah, unrepentant. And you know what? There's more of them out there now, I think, you know.
Or nativists, as they call them.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Ms. Ladner, about Medgar Evers. This is Maria Sanchez. Sorry.
My co-host. I'm sorry. We introduced her at the beginning of the show, but we miss. This is Maria Sanchez.
I think I've met you before.
Yes. Yes. I was at the Dick Gregory event in the District of Columbia.
Right.
Yes. Ooh, good memory.
He goes back a long way with me, too. Long way.
Because I did an independent study on the activism of Dick Gregory, and that's where I learned more about Medgar Evers and what he had done. And he's an icon of mine as well. And for you to actually have known him and what the work that he did, that he helped inspire you, what was that like for you as a young woman? I mean, you were a teenager, right?
To put it lightly, strongly, Mr. Evers was killed on June 12th, 1963, around midnight, close to midnight. But Dave Dennis, who worked for CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, Ann Moody, the young lady who wrote Coming of Age in Mississippi, myself and David Dennis, who worked for CORE. Chuck Hicks knows Dave Dennis from CORE down in Louisiana, Baton Rouge, where he comes from. We had been, President Kennedy had talked about the Civil Rights Bill. And, of course, everyone knows we go to sleep early in the South. So we went to get a bite to eat at the Elks Club. And Mr. Evers, the ones that I named, were in the party. So we got ready to leave. I got into the car with my cousin Maddie Bivens, who married Dave Dennis, and Moody, and we went home with them. Mr. Evers got into the car alone, and we were all leaving at the same time. And so he said, "See you in the morning. See you in the morning." And that was the last we saw of him alive. That night, I went home with Maddie, who's my cousin, and Dave, and we got into the bed. I got into the bed, and it seemed like the doors were opening and closing, the windows were opening and closing. I did not know anything about spirits and being warned or forewarned, but I could not sleep. I kept sitting up in the bed. And so probably about 1 o'clock, Maddie, my cousin, came and knocked on the door. She said, "Dory, Medgar's dead." I said, "I know it." And I covered my head up and got back in the bed. We got up about 5 or 6 that morning, and that's when Governor George Wallace was standing in the school door to prevent Hood and Malone from entering the University of Alabama.
I recall, he was shot down in the driveway of his home.
Of his home, yes.
Yeah. And his family was right there.
The NAACP office, 1072 Lynch Street in Jackson, Mississippi, picked up some T-shirts, we were told, and he drove home, and he was gunned down in a car port. And he could not get anyone, you've probably seen that too, to take him to Hospital St. Dominique, finally accepted him. But by that time, he bled out. They put a mattress in the back of a station wagon and took him to the hospital. He was refused maybe once or twice. And so when he finally got to the hospital, he was dead.
And we had a civil rights activist here, Ms. Ladner. I'm sorry that I can't remember his name right now because I'm getting so old. But he was also...
We all are.
I know. And he was drunk. They were going to hang him, but they put him back in his jail cell because of the Megar Evers thing. You probably
talking
remember.
About Lawrence Guillot?
Yeah, I'm talking about Lawrence
Guillot.
Yes, Guillot.
I spoke with Guillot that night, the next day, rather, because Guillot was in jail in Winona where Ms. Hamer, Uvester Simpson, June Johnson, who used to live here, were brutally, and Neil Ponder were brutally beaten. They had the audacity to get off this Greyhound bus. They were coming from South Carolina, a training meeting, and they went into this little restaurant. And so that was a no-no.
These kind of things going on.
Guillot was arrested. Eleanor Holmes Norton came the next day as a lawyer to try and have them released. And she was very lucky that she, number one, didn't get killed, beaten or killed, and she was able to get them released. But Guillot told us that night when it got very quiet, and he was frightened to death. And Ms. Hamer and all them had, all the females had been beaten beyond their lives. And so Guillot was so scared, he said that, "Dory, I knew they were coming to kill us." And he got quiet. And so daylight came, and Eleanor showed up from Greenwood, Mississippi. And that's how they were released. But when they got back down to Jackson, Mississippi, which is not probably about 70, 80 miles south, Guillot came there and he pulled his shirt off, and I've never seen a body so brutalized as I saw Guillot. Guillot was very fair skinned, and his body looked like a piece of raw beef that had been beaten. I mean, he was battered and bruised, and there are photographs of it. It was taken right in front of the NAACP office, again, as I would say, 1072 Lynch Street, Jackson, Mississippi. And he showed his body, his battered and bruised body. And I don't continue to have words to express. Ms. Hamer's eye was bloodshot. She could barely walk. She had been kicked and stomped. And the other young ladies with her were brutalized as well. It was just a horrible, 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 horrible occasion.
Are you surprised that 60 years later, we're still dealing with this, that we have the George Floyd trial going on right now, for example? Are you surprised at that? Or you know, it seems to me that we after the Civil Rights Movement, we swept some of this stuff under the rug, but we really haven't dealt with it. Do you feel that as well?
I wouldn't say that I'm surprised. All I can say is that I keep fighting the ones that I came up in movement with, continue to fight those of us who have the body and the energy and presence of mind to continue fighting, because the fight is never over, never over. When we came across the ocean, we were fighting, and we're still fighting. Right. And those who came to invade the capital of the United States came to Washington, D.C., to finish the Civil War, because when I was growing up in Mississippi, they continued to talk about the South shall rise again. When President Kennedy was killed, they were having Kennedy hash on the menu down in Jackson, Mississippi, where I was going to school at Tougaloo College. So the minds have not changed for the most part. I wouldn't say that everyone is not of that persuasion, because there have been engagements across the racial minds, but it would continue to take a lot. And our past president only exacerbated the goodwill that people had forged. He's just turned back the hand of time.
So you mentioned Tougaloo College, and I think our listeners should know, how is it that you went to Tougaloo since you initially started at Jackson State University? Because that's a story, too.
Is it what you asking me about the history of Tougaloo?
No, about how you went from Jackson State University to Tougaloo College.
Oh, Jackson State was a state college, and they didn't tolerate very much. My sister Joyce and I had known Mr. Meg Ebbers since we were teenagers, and NAACP youth chapter had been formed, and he came once or twice, and Mr. Clyde Kennard, who was sent to Parchman Penitentiary for trying to enroll in the University of Southern Mississippi, and subsequently died, was our manager, so to speak. But when we, that kind of stuff is kind of hard for me to talk about.
Well, if you don't want to talk about it, Ms. Latter, we certainly understand that there are some terrible memories, I'm sure, connected with this, and so don't feel obligated. Let me ask you a question about President Obama. Since you and I, one thing that we share in common is that we are both volunteers for President Obama. I volunteered in the primaries in Pennsylvania, and I also volunteered in Missouri for him, and it was very close in Missouri. He didn't win, but he came very, very close. Do you think that some of what we're seeing now is a backlash about having a black president for 8 years?
I can't say that it's a backlash. I spoke to the presence of the past president of the United States, calling a lot of the hatred to be, the seeds of hatred to be sowed. I would say that a lot of that had to do with, and there were people from where I grew up who had those thoughts, but they didn't have the arena, the stage, the platform in which to expound them. So the president gave them the platform.
Mm-hmm.
We had Ross Barnett, we had George Wallace, but they didn't have much of a platform.
Wallace. Yeah. Yeah. That's just an interesting side note, is that I worked in the shopping center where George Wallace was shot. I was late for work that day. But yeah, there have always been segregationists, and that's my next question, is do you think that when we talk about systemic racism, since our country was founded by slave owners, do you think we have to go right to the roots of our democracy to change that? Is there, are there things like the Electoral College and the filibuster and, remnants from Jim Crow that we need to get rid of and that we need to go right down to the foundations of
all of the above
democracy?
Needs to be challenged. you know, right now I'm not quite sure how much it will change, but we have to keep fighting. I'm one who believes that you never give up. You just keep moving.
Yeah. Well, as someone that's been involved in a fight that goes back 220 years, and that is getting equal rights for the people of District Columbia, I couldn't agree with you more. We have to, you know, we take one step forward and two steps back. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Maria.
May I ask you, Ms. Ladner, about your time with the Freedom Riders, and can you share with our listeners what that was
I'm
like?
I'm not a Freedom Rider. I got my inspiration from the Freedom Riders, Diane Nash, Reverend James Bevel, Paul Brooks, Catherine Brooks. These are students from Tennessee State University and Fisk University, all of whom were based in Nashville, Tennessee. Reverend Jim Lawson, who was teaching nonviolence, John Lewis, many other. Reverend C.T. Vivian came there, and they were the ones who were studying nonviolence, and they brought it to the larger community of students.
Well, one of the great things about living in Washington, D.C. is that I've gotten to meet many of these people like you and John Lewis, who was an amazing man in my opinion, and many others who reside here in the district. It bothers me sometimes that we're not able to mobilize people better. So what do you think we should be do you have any suggestions for us on how to mobilize more people? You know, we've been denied our basic civil rights, as you well know, Ms. Ladner, and there was a markup on a bill that will be going to the floor next week and will probably pass for D.C. statehood, but they had a rally before the markup, and 30 people showed up. What aren't we doing? I mean, we have 712,000 people. Are there things that we should be doing to get more people out there?
I was talking to Anise Jenkins earlier today, and she said that she had attended a meeting where there were quite a few young people gathered, called the 50-51. But
yeah,
that's where your hope lies. I had much more energy. I had much more fight in me, and all the people around me. You know, we kept moving. We were mobilizing, and some of your best mobilizers are no longer with us. So you have to turn around and get the hands of those who are out there who are able to do it. And you know, in urban areas, it's kind of difficult to organize a lot of people. Back there where we came from, we had space. Now today you have too many urban issues, housing, food, shelter, and people are worried about a lot of stuff, employment. You know, people lived on plantations, and they were kicked off because Dick Gregory came down there in 1963 and brought a plane load of food because the commodities, the cheese and the peanut butter and everything, was stopped once people tried to start registering to vote. They were living on a plantation, and they were told to leave the plantation. But that didn't stop anything.
Well, and we still have that going on, don't we? You can't bring a glass of water to somebody standing in line in Georgia. So.
Oh, my God. I can remember being in Georgia. Way back in Southwest Georgia, when Reverend James Bevel and Bernard Lafayette and John Lewis and all the people from Fisk came over, and Diane and all of them went down to Southwest Georgia. Bernice Johnson Reagan was lived there, and her husband Cardell and all of them were there. So they started the Freedom Singers, and Dr. King started right there in Albany, Georgia. But it got to be too much. But the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee stayed there. Reverend Charles Sherrod and Shirley Sherrod, you may have heard of Shirley Sherrod, who worked at the Department of Agriculture. But that's when we started our foundation. And Georgia had the most terrible laws. We had people on death row when we went to the March on Washington. We had to go and picket the Justice Department before we went to the March on Washington, that early that morning. because we had people on death row charged with insurrection. Feels like guys.
And you know what? I say this to my kids all the time because my kids are now in their mid to late 20s, act like all this stuff is ancient history. And I tell them, you know, I remember going to New Orleans with my family when I was 8 years old, and there were white drinking fountains and colored drinking fountains, and you know, and everything was segregated, and it really isn't ancient history. And I also remember and I'm sure you've seen this too, I know you did, and I ended up in Montgomery. My brother was stationed at Maxwell Air Force Base, and I went to Montgomery, and I remember going to the Civil Rights Memorial and standing in front of the Civil Rights Memorial and looking up at the state capitol, and there was the Confederate battle flag. I couldn't believe it. Right in the shadow of the Civil Rights Memorial, they were still flying the stars and bars. And I remember, and this was 30 years ago, and I remember some state legislator tried to climb up the flagpole, an African-American state legislator tried to climb up the flagpole and pull it down, and they arrested him. But, so you know, this stuff, I don't know how we impress young people that this isn't 100 years ago. It's not 200 years ago.
Well, that same flag you're talking about was brought to the nation's capital.
Yep.
On January 6th.
Yeah, yes, ma'am. We all saw it. With those,
the South is still fighting the Civil War, sir.
I know they are. What is that? I mean, I get that. Yeah, they really are. And you know, as you probably well know, Ms. Ladner, D.C. doesn't have Congress has control of D.C. because the framers were afraid of an insurrection. If they didn't have control of things, well, that's just not working out for them now, is it? They haven't gotten over that in the South, and I just don't get it. Go ahead.
No,
Maria.
They still won't get over it. And see, with Georgia having two senators now that are not Republican, that has really thrown them into the briar patch. They're very, very disturbed. And I think that statehood, the way they see it, you have two senators here, and they would rather die and go to hell than to do that. Put two senators in from the District of Columbia.
Yeah, not only two Democrats, but two liberal Democrats, and most likely two African American liberal Democrats. I'm sure this is their worst nightmare as we go into the Senate, where this is what we have to deal with. Go ahead, Maria. You have a question?
Yes, Ms. Ladner, I'd like you to share with our listeners, because I found it super inspirational as somebody who went back to school. I've earned two master's degrees in the last 4 years, and I'm working on my PhD now. You went back to school after being a wife and mother, and what was that like for you?
Well, I never stopped working. When I had about 15 credits shy of my bachelor's degree when I left school. I left school, I think, maybe three or four times. And I continued to do civil rights and civil social justice work. And so when I got married, it was I continued to do my hours for credits. And moved to Washington, D.C., and attended Howard University School of Social Work and got my MSW and started to work. You know, it was all in a day's work for me.
Which is, you were a non-traditional student, were you not? Getting your master's degree as a wife and mother, and there you are walking the walk. You're not only studying it academically, but you're living it on a day-to-day basis. With your
I had been living
work.
A horrible life for many, many years, so that was a piece of cake. I used to go to bed at night, every night, praying to God that I would wake up the next morning. I didn't want the Klan to throw a firebomb into our house and kill all of us. You know, that getting that degree on those conditions was nothing compared to the life that I had that I have lived.
Wow.
Yeah, I think a lot of younger people don't understand that.
Well, it's almost generational amnesia, because I know I have some gay male friends that are in their 50s that say that the younger gay men don't realize how scary HIV/AIDS was because of the medications that are available now. And then there's women who don't know what sports was like before Title IX. So we do sometimes forget our history, which is really like that's how it repeats itself, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why we need people like Doria Ladner to remind us of what our history is. And I also know that your sister Joyce was a civil rights activist as well. Is that right, Ms. Ladner?
She is more of an academician than an activist.
Mm-hmm. And is she still with us, and is she still in academia?
Yeah, she lives here in D.C.
Oh, she does. Yeah. We should ask you both to be on. Now we're running out of time.
We've gone down different paths for our struggles. Mm-hmm. My sister received her Ph.D. in 1968 from Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri. Started teaching at the university level. I continue to do my social justice work.
Well, University of Washington is a school I know, and it's a great school, too. But we're running out of time here, Ms. Ladner. So
yeah, I wanted to also give shout-outs to Mama Sandy, sent me a notice about Mama Nia's passing.
Yeah, can you talk about that for a minute? Yes, we did. And I feel neglectful in not mentioning that. And we all love Mama Sandy as well. She's been involved in, half the people you mentioned tonight. Denise Jenkins. Chuck, who's been on our
Chuck
show.
Chuck Hicks. He's the one who told Hicks. Me he was so excited that I was going to be on your show. He was
beside himself, aside from
all the others. And Brenda and Jerome, I've known them. You know, Brenda and Jerome go back to the late Dr. James Foreman. They set aside a vigil around, we call him Jim's bed, when he was in hospice care here in the district over near Sidwell Friends. And I should never forget that, to see people who I didn't know and who just embraced Jim and treated him like a parent. You know, he was their parent. It warms my heart. It warms my heart. I can't say enough about them. I don't see them as often as I used to, but all of the statehood people came out. Faith with her horn and her husband, and Jim's room just stayed full of people around his bed until he took his last breath. They were there, the vigil.
Well, you know
that
what?
That says so much for the statehood movement.
And the thing that surprises me about all of you, Dory, about you and Chuck and Anise and Dick Gregory and Faith.
Oh, my God, I met Dick Gregory a long time ago.
And you know, I just talked to Faith's husband, Jude, 2 days ago.
You did?
How's he doing? He's good. He's good.
My regards,
of course, he misses
his
wife, who's such a force. I got to tell you, because I think this will make you laugh, Dory. But Faith was always on my back about doing stuff for statehood. And I saw her at the 4th of July. I saw her at the 4th of July parade a few years ago on horseback. She was on horseback by herself.
She was?
And I had a T-shirt on. I had a statehood T-shirt on, and I said to her, Faith, look, I have statehood in my heart. And as fast as I said it, she looked down at me and said, good, now get your head out of your ass and do something. So that was Faith, right? And she was an amazing person. And Dori Ladner, you're an amazing person, and you honor us by being on our show. So
you know, I want to speak up. Excuse me for cutting you off. I want to speak up for Congressman Jamie Raskin, who came to the forefront during this horrible time that we witnessed in January, and he continues, and you know, even in the dark hours when he lost his son, you know, but he continued to move forward. So that's, I want to give a shout out to him, and my prayers continue for him and his family, and to go forward. Also, Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, whom I've known since I was probably a sophomore in college in Mississippi. She came to Mississippi with two majors. She was studying law and history at the same time. And also, I would like to give a shout out to our mayor. She's young and she is eager to learn. I saw her face light up when the markup was approved and so forth, but she's very vigilant about statehood, which is a very good sign.
That
she's
is
young
good
enough
sign.
To go forward and to mobilize younger people.
Nice.
And both Jamie Raskin and Eleanor Holmes Norton have been guests on our show. So
we
agree with you 100%. They're remarkable. And you know what? I always had a lot of respect for Congresswoman Norton, but I got much more respect for her when I got this job and realized that she's done so much without a vote. She is such an incredible she's been an incredible asset to the people of District Columbia. So, Dori Ladner, thank you so much for being on our show.
And thank you.
And you know what? We leave every week with a song, and we dedicate it usually to our guests. So here's a song for you. I love this song. I wouldn't be surprised if you love it too. Here's Sam Cooke with "A Change Is Gonna Come."
That was our anthem in 1964 during Freedom Summer.
Oh, my gosh. Right?
It's a great song. And thank you, Dori Ladner. And thank you, and Maria Sanchez.
Thank everybody on Radio Land. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Good night.
And keep on pushing.
Bye-bye.
We will. Thank you. You're an inspiration.
Just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die, 'cause I don't know what's up there.